appreciate the presence of everyone here this morning. You are our honored guest, especially those visiting with us. I'm going to try to jump right into this because we're at that time of year where the desert is getting hot, and then to pile something worse on top of it, it's getting humid. And I'm in front of a projector that's pumping out heat, and I'm wearing a dark shirt. So we're going to try to get through this and get you out of here, you know, hopefully, you know, within a reasonable amount of time, and back to your air-conditioned cars. You know, so listen up real close, hopefully you'll get something out of this that'll be beneficial to you, not only for the day, but hopefully for the rest of your life. At least that's what Peter's intent was. As we continue on in the context of the study of 2 Peter, and Phil just read some of the previous context, you might want to turn in your Bibles to 2 Peter 2 to see the full context of what we're talking about. We'll make a quick reference to it as we go through an introduction. In 2 Peter 2, 1 through 11, starting the second chapter here. Get my button straight. I hit the wrong button. There we go. Okay, in chapter 1, Peter's made an invitation for his readers to aspire to, or continue to aspire to, the divine nature. For many who consider themselves Christians, they don't understand even the first principles involved. That the whole process of Christianity, as Peter gets into, has to do with getting back the divine nature. As we said before in Genesis 1, we were created in God's image. By Genesis 6, we lost it. Okay? So for people nowadays to think, oh, they're fine, all they have to do is believe, I'm okay, you're okay, that they're not really sinners, whatever, have missed the point entirely. We are sinners. We're not on the level of spiritual maturity that God intended us to be. And Peter is a good example of this because he's telling us, you know, it's the divine nature that gave us all this technique, the scriptures, insight, wisdom, and everything to start getting back to the divine nature. That's what the purpose of Christ was. If you look at Romans, the 8th chapter, verse 29, Ephesians, the 4th chapter, verses 23 through 25, our goal as Christians is to become Christ-like, which means, as we just got through looking in the last context, which means God-like. And this is what, you know, the world, you know, should be shooting for. This is what God wants us to acquire too. So the divine nature then gives details on how to achieve it by various additions, diligently added to one's faith. Okay, so you need to add things to your faith. One, the very first one is wanting to excel, to become better. Okay. So we go on. Then he then qualifies it all by stating that this divine nature was attested to by the apostles, who were eyewitnesses of the proclamation of the Father on the divine glory of the Son. Now, keep in mind, you know, we're talking about glories here. What was in the context that Phil read, which we covered last week, is there's a strange title ascribed to the Father. He's looked at as the majestic glory. And this glory he attests to in his Son, you know, which is what we're trying to acquire also. Now, that's going to be relevant as we come into chapter 2 as to what we're pitted against. That's out in the world. So keep that in mind. We'll come back to it just as a reminder. And that the testimonies are given are not only personal. I mean, Peter says, we saw this stuff. We heard God testify to his Son that he was, you know, someone he's delighted in, that his glory was the same, that he was his Son, made in his image. Not made, but in his image. And they were guided also, and directed by the Holy Spirit. Further, now against those who would denounce all this as fallacious myths, Peter begins chapter 2, warning his readers about the insidious, and I'm using Peter's word, animals, really, the way they're behaving yourselves, who are about to come in among them and try to discredit this whole marvelous phenomenon. It's not enough that the church has to battle against problems that are in the world, all sorts of fronts that are out there. But it's interesting that, you know, what we get our greatest warnings about are those that are coming from inside. We're just studying about it in Acts, where Paul is warning the elders at Ephesus that there's going to be wolves among them, and it's going to come from the eldership. And so over and over again, you know, people come in from the world and they don't divorce themselves of worldly thinking. They bring the world into the church and it festers, it grows, whatever, and it comes into, becomes a creature sometimes even more worse than the world. If you can believe that, but it's, you know, evident. They're going to have people come in, Peter warns them, to discredit the whole marvelous phenomena about the glory of the Father and of the Son. So we're going to cover the first 11 verses here of chapter 2. I usually bog down in verse 1, so don't get worried, you know, if we spend a lot of time on that, because we'll get through the rest of them fairly quickly. But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there also be false teachers among you, who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. Now notice the phrase, but arose, is an aorist, and Peter's still staying with historical aorist. What he's saying is just simple fact. Although it should be noticed here that what he's saying is also something to come in the future. He's prophesying. The also here relates back to 19 and 21 from the first chapter, indicating the rise of the false prophets that occurred among the people. Laos is the people of God from the Old Testament. Just as, or exactly as, God's people now would have false teachers among them. Among Peter's readers, there would not be those who would claim direct revelation or inspiration. They're not going to come in as false apostles, as Paul had to deal with at times, but rather what they were do is bring in secretly, stealthily, sneaky, covert lies. They're just going to slip them in. You know, this is the biggest problem of the church. Yeah, and why we get so many different religions and so many movements out there is because the individual member doesn't know his scriptures. They do not know when they're being taught falsehood. A lot of times we rely on, you know, what some older preachers call a social gospel. Oh, we can bring them in through, you know, bowling leagues or baseball games or, you know, whatever. But that doesn't make quality Christians. Okay? And in essence, a lot of times the attitude is, if we can do that, then I don't really have the responsibility of actually having to study and even memorize the scriptures. But that's our Achilles heel, if you want to put it. If everyone knew what God taught, a lot of this stuff just, you know, wouldn't take off at all. And the church would still be what it was. But, yeah, as Peter says, it's going to start here in the first century, and it's going to run rampant even for 2,000 years. And this is mostly what we're contending with. In fact, wait a minute, I've got to go back a little bit. Also, as he calls about these destructive heresies, they are opinions producing destruction. And notice, they're opinions. There's nothing received from God. They're not even truths. Okay, their doctrines or teachings one chooses for oneself. This is what Paul talks about, you know, acquiring teachers because we have itching ears. We look to be told what we want to hear. And they introduce grave aberrations. That is, they get off from the scriptures, they get off from, you know, the gospel into areas that, you know, are totally foreign to what God tries to teach. The chief thrust of these heresies is deny the master who bought them. You know, it's like, these are people that came into Christianity understanding what Christ did for them, the Son of God on the cross that makes it possible for their sins to be forgiven. Now after becoming Christians, they're going to deny all that and try to persuade others, you know, to change. By their teachings, they refute that Christ is the Son of God, that he lived a perfect life, that he died as a sacrifice and rose again from the dead. The term master here, denying the master, is, you know, where do we get our word despot from, although it has a bad connotation, also has a good one, from which we get, it stresses the absolute and unrestricted power of God. That's what they deny. Is God a despot? Yes, he's a benevolent dictator, best you'll ever have. But they want to deny that he has absolute and unrestricted power. And that's something that's a main theme throughout the Old and New Testament, and people forget. We're going to get into it in Ecclesiastes tonight. No, we're not, next week. And also through 2 Peter. Yeah. These false teachers and challenge this power of God and ungratefully scorn the cost of Christ's blood. Thus, the destruction they bring about by their lies is mainly upon themselves, and it will come swiftly. Now, this is prophetic too. We talk about, you know, because Peter's saying it's going to come speedily, impending, near at hand. Their argument's going to be, well, what about the promise of his coming and all that? You know, we haven't seen it yet. That doesn't mean that it hasn't already started. One of the things we saw in the study of Acts was, okay, here's Herod, and he gets, you know, he's wearing, as Josephus says, some sort of mail, you know, some mail and armor or whatever that just is all silver, glistens in the sun, and the people say, oh, he's a god. And he didn't deny it. Now, did God strike him dead that very minute that he collapsed in front of the people? No. But it was that instance that the condemnation of God started, you know, and it progressed, and it grew, and it began to eat him from the inside out, and eventually he died of worms, very painful death. So just so, because you don't see it immediately, doesn't mean that the destruction or the judgment hasn't already started. That's some of the things that Peter's trying to tell us. Now, here is a clear refutation of Calvin's doctrine of limited atonement. For even these false teachers, Christ died for. Notice here, he, the master, bought them. So a lot of Calvin says, okay, well, yeah, he picks a few. No, he died for all. Or that you're once saved, you're always saved. These guys were saved at one point. Christ bought them. Blood cleansed them. Now they're turning against him. And they're falling from grace. And boy, how they're going to fall. Peter's got some very graphic descriptions coming up at the end of this chapter. Many will follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of truth will be maligned. Unfortunately, many will listen to them, still do. Sensuality, or licentiousness, that is feeling that you have a license to do anything. Now, that's a big problem in people's thinking. It's not merely a reference to sexual aberrations, but extremes and excesses of all manners are being encouraged. That is, just get away from all of God's authority. You know, go any way you want to. Further, even the way, the truth, is maligned. The word here you can see in the Greek is our word blaspheme, reviled, cursed, condemned. This is what they're doing to God's word and to even God himself. Like I said, you know, people that, that formerly were Christians are now behaving worse than the world does. And in their greed, they'll exploit you with false words. Their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. The word exploit here means to make merchandise of, to traffic in, to take advantage of. That's the only reason they're doing it. They're taking advantage of you. They want your money. They want to have power over you. This is what they're doing. Their fellow Christians, you know, with false the word false words, fabricated, man, you know, whatever they accuse Peter of, that's what they're doing. In fact, that's what you see a lot in politics now. People are accusing others of the very thing that they're guilty of. You know, it's better to muddy the other person with the words, you know, before they get to you. And that's what they were doing with God here in the apostles. For the sake of their own greed, that is hunger, covetousness. Because they manipulate the truth or outright lie in order to get God's people to sell themselves to these false teachers cheaply, Peter says that the sentence of divine judgment against them was handed down long ago. This is where Peter's talking about the swiftness of it. When we talk about predestination, people want to say that God's pointing out individuals, but he's not. What he's doing is he's looking at a type of people. So he's predestined the type of people from the first chapter. Those that hear the word gladly, believe in God, and start adding to their faith, that's the predestined character that God is going to save. There's also a predestined character, this, that he's marked out from the very beginning for destruction and judgment. And this is what they're fitting themselves into. God is not letting it slide. In fact, he's had their destruction, their condemnation in the works from long ago. They will not succeed in this life. They will not succeed in the other one. He's already made provision for it. And we'll see that in the examples that he's bringing up. Notice the sentence. The sense is not idle, that is, it doesn't linger, is not put off like men's judgment, nor is the execution of their destruction sleeping. Peter's trying to warn them. Okay? This is a litotes, meaning that this, you know, we're talking full of these, you know, this is what Peter, you know, likes to deal with. This is something that says lesser in the opposite direction. So when you see it, not idle, what it is really saying is you take off the knot and go, what's the farthest extreme and more powerful of idol? Okay, so litotes meaning full of the deadliest energy to execute itself. Especially since the distortion of truth is the most heinous of crimes. What's going to cost people their souls? Distorting the truth. This is the worst thing you can do to somebody is lie to them about what God says. And this is one of the things that God absolutely hates. And he's going to deal with it swiftly. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness, reserved for judgment, the sentence goes on. In fact, verses 4 through 8 are one long sentence composed of illustrations of this terrible reality that Peter's bringing forth to him. Of a truth, why would men think that God would not deal with their rebellion if he did not even spare angels when they sinned? Okay? As the Bible describes, angels are here, we're here. What makes you think you're going to get off? Okay? If he's going to deal with a being that's on a higher plane than we are, he's not going to overlook, you know, what we're doing. Okay? One point. And their judgment was fierce, consigned to pits. Some suggest change, whatever, it doesn't matter, of darkness. The gloom of thick blackness, we looked at the term also in the previous chapter, as a light, you know, in a dark place, you know, of a kind of a gloom where there's perils, there's problems, there's danger. This is what he's consigned them to. A residence in hell, Tartarus, in Greek mythology, was the place of punishment of the Titans. You know, those giants that ruled the earth and Zeus overthrew them, where he consigned them to was Tartarus. And so just picking up the description and everything else, Peter says this is where God put the angels that sinned. And did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. Nor can men think that they can get lost in a crowd. Well, if the whole world is doing it, everybody else is doing it, maybe it's okay if I just go along with the flow. Really, okay? Peter points out that God destroyed the entire ancient world. You know, where are you going to hide? You know, if God is mad at everybody, everybody's going to suffer. The flood, the great deluge, our word, cataclysm, Greek word, except for Noah and his immediate family. Noah is preserved or guarded because he is described as a herald of righteousness. That's the, you know, take the whole world and you only got eight people that are doing the right thing. God destroys the whole world, he's going to destroy the righteous too. No. You know, God's powerful enough that he can segregate the righteous from the wicked. Even if he has to destroy everything, he will provide a means to protect those that are his. You know, this is something to really get across in our minds. Okay, don't let the world's opinions and think-sos and pressures, whatever, convince you of something that's not true. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly thereafter. A further example was made of Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, I know for a long time people said fictitious cities. You know, no evidence of. Well, we got evidence now. Okay, in the diggings of Ebla in northern Syria, they came across, you know, a whole library of merchandise tablets dealing with the five cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah specifically mentioned. We've known that for a while. Real cities, where are they? Well, they're in the south end of the Dead Sea. What God did to them left such a divot that expanded the Dead Sea another third. Okay? And this is what it says. Three terms are used. They were condemned, that is, judged, and remain so. You're never going to see them again. Okay? When he got rid of them, there's no way they're going to rebuild on the sites. They were destroyed. Our word catastrophe is used. And they were reduced to ashes. Well, we would say incinerated. Gone. Not even the ashes left, really. Now, if he rescued righteous Lot, just as he rescued Noah from the flood, he rescued Lot from the destruction of these two cities. Yeah. Because he did not go along with their sensual conduct. Here's something to argue with people about. Compare Jude 7, Genesis 19, 5 through 8. I've sat in a Catholic seminar one time where, you know, the priest that was teaching, you know, made the point that, you know, all the thing that all that Sodom and Gomorrah were guilty of was lack of hospitality. Okay, that's the big thing now in the world, lack of hospitality. That's not what that's described in Genesis 19. These people wanted to mate with guys. Okay? It's here called sensual conduct. That's the way Peter describes it. Jude 7, look at that context. It gets even further into it, exactly what they were doing wrong. By what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. Yeah, you get that way because somebody's not being hospitable. No, it's because of all the raunchy, lawless, sensual, you know, sick, whatever things that were going on. You know, he tortured himself. You know, Peter explains how Lot was oppressed. It was by what he saw and what he heard. When one is righteous, one tortures one's own soul beholding the lawless deeds. For us to look at ourselves, introspective. What's going on around you? Does it bother you? Does it bother you? Some of the shows you see on TV, some of the movies you see, some of the music that's being played, some of the magazines that are out there. Does it bother you? If not, you got some inventorying to do. You got some reassessment, reevaluation, some restructuring to do in your own heart. Yeah. It should be twisting your soul, you know, in all sorts of directions to see what's going on in the world, what's happening to your loved ones, you know, of the things that you love are being destroyed by what's going on. Okay, that's how it affected Abraham. That's how it affected Lot. That's how it affected Noah. Okay. And it will get you safe. This is why it's critical that you need to feel this way. You know, feel the weight of sin and the need to do something about it. In fact, that's what I said. Okay. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation to keep the righteous under punishment for the day of judgment. God is in sympathy with such individuals as Lot and Noah, for he himself is so moved by sins. God doesn't look down and go, oh, okay, well, it's getting worse. No, it's his creation. He takes it personally. This is what, you know, Peter is trying to get across. You sin, you do this stuff, and you think God's just going to let it slide? God knows how to rescue, deliver the godly from temptation or trial. The emphasis in this life, as with examples, is not just in final judgment. It's with the life you're dealing with. In all these examples, the destruction of the world, you know, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, did God wait till the end of judgment, the end of time to deal with them? No, that's part of the example. He dealt with them then. He didn't let it slide. He also knows how to keep, that is, in verse 4, reserve, we've already looked at, the unrighteous in punishment. That is, being punished, to keep them in punishment, you know, present tense, for or until the day of judgment. So not only are they going to get it on the day of judgment, he knows how to keep them, you know, under sentence until that day, being punished. And especially those who indulge in the flesh, in its corrupt desires, Peter's getting more graphic now, and despise authority. Daring, self-willed, they do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. taken special interest of by God are those who indulge, that is, lust for the corruption of the flesh, both their own and others. And just the way the world works. It can't be satisfied with just killing itself. It's got to kill all those around it. Another special category is those who despise or think themselves superior to authority, especially God. They are daring, that is, they're presumptuous, they're audacious, they're bold in a bad way, and self-willed, one who pleases self, willful, obstinate, arrogant. That's the crux of it. They're so arrogant that they think they're better than God, that they're smarter than God, that they're more powerful than God, that they can do anything they want and God's going to have to take it. Individuals are so foolish and stupid that they do not fear when they revile or blaspheme angelic majesties. Okay, the word that's used here is just the Greek word doxos, which is glories. I think we have a problem here with the translation. Now, I understand where they're going from because, what kind of glories are you talking about? It immediately follows, has to talk about angels and that's going on. But I think the context needs to be understood from what's previously looked at. And then you can understand what follows. Previously, as I pointed out, we talked about the majestic, as Peter describes God the Father. And he ascribed that glory to the Son. Those are the glories that we're talking about. These people revile or blaspheme even the glory of God. And Peter's going to tell them how foolish, how stupid they are to do that. Note this. There's no basis for the word angel. Okay, that's what I just covered. The true glories of God. Whereas angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord, these puny men do what even angels don't dare to do. Compare Jude 9. The example that Jude gives us, here you've got Michael the archangel, and you've got Satan, and they're contending over the body of Moses. And he said, even an archangel would not revile even Satan. This is how serious it is. Even an archangel, who's like the highest of the angels, wouldn't revile the nastiest, meanest, most evil of the fallen ones. So where does man get off reviling God? Something to think about. Especially in this day and age, because this is what our culture is doing. I think we got one more thing. Angels, even mightier, more powerful, do not venture to bring a... I'm going to get you out of here early. We're not going to go through the summary real quick. Quick invitation. And this is what we need to think about in this culture. The pressure is building, and it's coming from all sorts of angles. Okay, your peers will put it on you. I noticed the way TV's going, the comedy channel is just totally off limits, for me now. They remind me of the old ribald poets, the ones that just always were against those in authority, always had something bad to say. They did it in a nasty, seductive way, in a mocking way. They never built anything. They just incited riots and things. That's what a lot of the stand-up comedians remind me of. He used to say that every other word was a four-letter word. Now it's hard to find a word that isn't a four-letter word. There's no humor in it. There's no real inventiveness. It's just, And then there's people that pay to listen to this stuff. Which way is the world going? Okay. The humanistic doctrine has taken over the school system to put down God. Okay? The science community. Here's a people that believe in evolution. They believe in a pseudoscience that violates every scientific law you learn about in biology 101. And it, yeah, and, but they get followers. I mean, the kids, they go through biology 101. They learn all the cell theory and all this kind of stuff. And then they listen to somebody tell them, some professor supposedly, you know, that evolution, although it violates all the scientific principles, is true. And these are the people that are pushing pressure on. And I'll tell you, there's even agnostics and atheists from the past that realize you can't go that direction. One French poet who was an atheist commented that if you get rid of Christianity, you've gotten rid of Western civilization. I mean, what are you going to replace it with? What Christianity has done, and our founding fathers knew this, is put a conscience into governing. Yeah, that has put a consideration of psychological effects. Okay. If the people respect God, respect the government, they will follow it and be obedient to it on their own will. If you take all that out and the people don't like what's going on, you're going to have to grind them under your thumb. And that's where socialism, you know, comes in. That's what it's headed for. Socialism hasn't worked any other place that's been tried. But again, capitalism won't work either if you take God out of the formula. I mean, very simply, our founding father said, well, we stake everything on the Ten Commandments, whether you believe in the Old or New Testament or not, it should be involved with. We can actually make this better by going by, you know, principles of the New Testament than the Old. But just, yeah, the Ten Commandments, what are you going to replace them with? Just pick like the fifth one, thou shalt not murder. What are you going to replace it with? When you get rid of that one, what's not possible? Okay. And if you take God out of it, the psychology is, yeah, what keeps people from doing what's wrong? Other than a fear of God and judgment, which is what Peter's trying to get across. When nobody's looking, when you think you'll never get caught, and it's to your own benefit, what keeps you from lying, stealing, cheating, or even killing somebody? Unless you know there's somebody watching and you will give an account for it. Don't let people browbeat you out of Christianity. Don't let them convince you otherwise. Don't let them pressure you. It's time to take a stand. Okay, if you don't, you'll be run right over. Yeah, it doesn't matter if the whole world goes worldly. In Judgment Day, would you rather be with the ancient world or would you rather be with Noah? Seriously, think about it. Okay. And that gives us our closing song. We're going to be singing Christ Beckoning, Heart Bowed Down with Sorrow, whatever. And it goes along with, I'm glad Dan picked a lot of these songs to go along with the sermon of our own introspection, you know, how we look at sin. You know, are we moved to, you know, to fight against it? Are we going to make a stand with God against the world? I've been in the audience, grew up in the church, whatever. I know that there's times in my life, you know, huge windows of it, when I sat there and didn't listen to the thing that the preacher was saying. Okay? Didn't get anything from the lesson, didn't stop to think about the context, didn't really consider that the Bible is going to be that useful to me. Okay? Until I stepped out in the world, and when you do, you're going to run into a crossroads. Hopefully, some of it went in subconsciously for young people. And you realize, hey, it's going to come back to you as you run into problem after problem after problem. Oh, God did have the answer. He has taught us in all things pertaining to life and godliness. If you do not take the word into you, if you do not know what it says, if you do not grow to maturity, and you step out in the world, you might as well step in front of a freight train because it's going to go right over you. And it's going to lead you along all sorts of paths. And one day, like the prodigal son, you're going to wake up eating the stuff even the pigs want. You're going to wonder how I got here and how much better I had it off when I was with God's people. Time for decision is now. If there's anything we can do to help, to make the decision to come to God, you know, to serve Him to the best of your ability. I mean, this is what the church is for. A lot of Christians helping each other, growing to the maximum, to become Christ-like. If there's anything we can do to help, please let us know as we stand to sing.